You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Zine on KSJD. I'm Tom Yoder. It is our fall membership drive going on right now. Support programming like the zine that we bring you here on KSJD every weekday morning. Give us a call at 970-564-0808. You can also pledge securely online at ksjd.org. Cedar Mesa in southeast Utah is a popular area for hiking and backpacking to see ancestral Pueblo and cliff ruins and rock art in a natural setting. Many miles of spectacular canyons lined with cliffs cut through the mesa. Some archaeological ruins in the areas are amazingly inaccessible, perched high on ledges and under overhangs. The many canyons that cut through Cedar Mesa offer scenery and wildlife, as well as the solitude of desert canyons, where one can explore and come to better understand one's place in the natural world and within a deeper tapestry of time. Joining me this morning to talk about Cedar Mesa is Fred Blackburn. He's an author, historian, and archaeologist, and he's here to talk about the amazing archaeology and beautiful landscapes of the greater Cedar Mesa area. I want to remind you that the Friends of Cedar Mesa will be holding their 2013 Celebrate Cedar Mesa event on Saturday, November 2nd in Bluff, Utah. The theme of this year's event is Beyond the Archaeological Story. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. I want to let Mark know that I actually woke up and made it here this morning.
That's Mark Malloy, who's organizing. Is he the chairman of the board over at Friends of Cedar Mesa?
He's the executive director.
Executive director.
For the Friends of Cedar Mesa.
Thank you. That's Mark Malloy. He's pulling that event together this weekend. Fred, I'm curious about how you got to know Cedar Mesa. Tell me a little bit about your history poking around over in those parts.
Well, in 1973, I was hired to work as a ranger at Natural Bridges National Monument. And prior to that, I'd been out in that area a time or two, but I didn't like it. It was too dang much desert for a mountain boy. So it's a place that really grew on you. In 1974, there was an effort to implement a ranger program in that area, specifically for Grand Gulch in southeastern Utah. And it was being driven to supplement the primitive area. It was supported by Senator Moss. And about $96,000 was dumped on us to install a ranger program out there in 3 months. And my wife and I were the first rangers hired at that point to work out there. So it was kind of it was a mixed bag. In many ways, it was like my Vietnam, as I say. and we were all kids at that point, essentially, just young individuals, and we had a lot of growing to go through there, including learning about the archaeology and the history there. So I was a ranger for 7 years there, leaving in 1979 to come over here for Crow Canyon, but I never really lost my touch with there. Just kind of as a clarification, it's just a historian gitch, but Cedar Mesa is actually just a little bit of a mesa that goes out into what's now known as the Moki Dugway. The area that's mostly focused was the Grand Gulch Plateau, and I like saying that name. But Cedar Mesa's kind of like basket maker for
it's sort of all encompassing, yeah.
It's all encompassing, and so right. Anyway, we were at that point we were given a set of keys and a Jeep and said, go learn your area. And we had one place we checked in once a week with our BLM office to let them know we were still alive. and that kind of freedom was totally rare.
Doesn't happen much anymore.
It doesn't happen at all. You're lucky to find a place that doesn't have cell service.
Yeah.
So, and that was good and bad. But within the first 2 or 3 years, I think 75 or 80% of our ranger staff was hospitalized from accidents.
Wow.
And really attribute that to a lot of young kids being put in an area that they really didn't know, nor did the agency really know what hazards we were going to find.
What kind of accidents, what kind of hazards were you dealing with? Was it falls?
We dealt with horse kicks, we dealt with car wrecks and horse trailer wrecks and rock falls and One of the rangers that worked with me lost his leg in a rock fall.
Wow.
He was pinned under it, and three of the BLM folks got the national awards for that from BLM for their risk that they took in getting him out.
Mm.
So it was mainly learning the rules and learning the country. It takes about 3 years at that point to learn it. We also, there was no pavement out there. It was 1976 that they put in the bicentennial highways. So when we went to town to be back for a month or so.
So you're talking about in the early 70s, early mid-70s here.
Right.
Was anybody really out there at that time? Did you have tourists out there?
We didn't have tourists out there. We were dealing with a different kind of wilderness experience, and that is that we were placed in a place to break up, essentially, folks that were getting their wilderness experience through pot hunting, arrowhead hunting, and mm-hmm. other, at that time, uses of the land, which in many cases were still accepted locally. So we really ran interference and had, so I recall, three congressional investigations, three congressional inquiries on our ranger program during those years.
What was that about? Why was that going on?
It was mainly because we were interfering with a local attitude of use upon the land.
So locals were calling up and complaining about what was going on with the rangers?
No, they were leaving us. There were a lot of charges filed against us, either uh-huh. from anonymous letters or whatever. Luckily, we had a good relationship with the sheriff's office. We had to.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And that's one of the presenters will be Rigby Wright through those years.
And that's at the Friends of Cedar Mesa event this weekend in Bluff.
Right, and it begins at 1 o'clock with Mark doing an introduction. And around 4:15, well, there's some really neat stuff. There's Scott Thibany, who has kind of followed up beyond Everett Roos. For those who have followed Everett Roos, to other missing individuals that occurred during that 1930 time period, and he's fantastic, both as a photographer and a writer. And that starts at 1:15, and this is going to be held there at the community center in Bluff, which I don't have an address for it, but about 5 minutes of driving, you can find it. And then it's followed by Nemo, a film about Everett Roos by Corey Robinson, and Von Haydenfelt will be doing the introduction and discussion for that. He was involved heavily with David Roberts in the search for Everett Roos a few years ago. And then around 4:15, we've got the Rogues Gallery, and we have Bill Leip, who... he was at Museum of Northern Arizona when we were working out there as rangers, and he and his crew were very much responsible for helping me get interested in learning about the archaeology of the area.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Wednesday Morning Zine on KSJD. I'm Tom Yoder. I'm speaking this morning with Fred Blackburn. He's a local author, historian, and an archaeologist. We're talking about Cedar Mesa this morning, and I want to let people know that the Friends of Cedar Mesa are holding their 2013 Celebrate Cedar Mesa event this Saturday, November 2nd, in Bluff, Utah. I want to back up a little bit, Fred, and talk about the archaeology, because I think that I have a background in archaeology. You certainly have a background in archaeology. We've seen those sites out there, but for people who've never been out to Cedar Mesa, who don't really know what's out there, give us a sense of what is the archaeology like out there?
Well, your archaeology is quite complex in that is the center of the Western basket maker too, the folks prior to the development of pottery. But it's also an intersection for many other things. It's kind of the contact area with the Kayenta on Asazi further to the west. And for whatever reason, in Pueblo II, the Mesa Verdean people and the Kayenta were pretty much kind of trying to figure out whose territory it was, I think you could say. But we also, I shouldn't say we, but Winston Hearst and many others have since found a lot of Chacoan road systems going to Chacoan sites. There's been continued research on the basket maker. And it's, well, if you think about this, in 1950, there were no roads out there. The roads were placed because of the mines from the Marquis and the Happy Jack mine. And the road was built, 261, that runs down the Mesa off what's now known as the Moki Dugway, which initially was Isabel Hill, and it was a way to get ore off the top of the Mesa. And the Moki Dugway really became, it's, you know, a slang term at the, at that point. But when those roads opened up, the archaeology was reopened up. Prior to that, you have Wetherill and McLeod and Graham and various other folks that are moving through their horseback and involved in the discoveries of the early archaeology. So there's the archaeology makes a mesa. The geology itself is gorgeous. You know, we have the canyons of the ancients here, but that red sandstone of the Cedar Mesa, the pinky sandstone, and the alcoves that are formed within it just create an incredible experience for people. The other uniqueness of that area with the archaeology is that it's one of the few places where you can experience it without tickets and guides, and that in itself creates a tremendous problem.
Well, I was going to ask you, you look at this archaeology out there, and the preservation is really incredible. You get into places like Grand Gulch, and people always remark, it looks like people just walked away yesterday at those sites, you know, because there's just corn cobs laying around and all kinds of things. As you look at that archaeology, and you look even at the accessibility of that area, what are some of the biggest challenges out there? Is it just managing people coming out there more and more?
Well, word of mouth. And of course, the internet now has really destroyed the experience for a lot of people. You can go on there, and it's moved to a group of ruin bagging. And so you don't really have, it's too easy for people to go to these sites and to the more secure ones. You have a lack of funding, and in my case, I would say even a lack of commitment by the BLM during the years we were there to protect the site because the politics was too severe, and the repercussions from the locals were not fun. Let's put it that way. So when you look at all these impacts that are coming on, and that's what Friends of Cedar Mesa is really all about, is, you know, the first time that someone goes through there and has the experience seeing what's there, they don't have the 30 or 40 years of history of watching it deteriorate. But they still have the same experience I had for the first time when I saw the sites. So, you know, this is really difficult because we have a nation that really, really right now doesn't want to earn anything, and you have all these information sources out there which destroy the sense of self-discovery, and a lot of the information is really shallow. It's not a Paul Harvey rest of the story kind of information. Sure. That's what I believe that they're really after with Beyond the Archaeological Story, is you've got an environment out there that's unique, that supported cultures, and now, for one reason or another, you know, you just can't have enough people on the ground to regulate.
You're tuned into the Wednesday Morning Zine. This is KSJD. It's our fall membership drive right now. Support programs like the zine that you're listening to right now. Insightful, in-depth news and stories about Four Corners area topics and issues. You can call us at 970-564-0808. Or make a pledge securely online at ksjd.org. I'm Tom Yoder. This morning I'm talking with Fred Blackburn about Cedar Mesa and the Friends of Cedar Mesa. Fred, how do we go about educating people about the rest of the story beyond the archaeological story of Cedar Mesa?
Well, I think all of us that have a lot of experience here have wrestled with it. You want to write about it, but in the process of writing, if you're not careful, you help destroy it. And you never know what your effects are going to be. I mean, it's a great example of that was David Roberts wrote a book, In Search of the Old Ones. And we had no idea at that point that we were going to be dealing with canyon caching systems and mm-hmm. having GPS become part of it, and then the internet step into it, and by doing those writings, it created a search for the artifact. We tried various experiments. The one that I used all the time before the internet was just leaving notes in places that we've found this. This is what it means. Please leave it in place. But after that, I know that Vaughn, in at least one case, during his guiding, we had people that followed him into some of the caches that we had left in place, and they were stolen by that.
They were actually trailing him into
trailing
those
him
areas.
To see where the artifacts were, because we then had the notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's you got to have some self-discipline in a culture, and that's what I see really lacking. It's a fascinating learning lab. The archaeology is really, I think, in its infancy for understanding out there. And the purpose of this group is really looking at more advanced protections and support for that whole area, whether it were to become a national monument or, which is going to be, in this climate, in Utah, probably one of the most difficult things that could possibly happen. And with sequestration and funding, it just adds a cap to it.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Do you know much about the National Monument as it's proposed? Is there a definitive proposal that's out there? Does it include all of Cedar Mesa? Tell me more about this idea around this National Monument.
This I'm going to have to defer on, because okay. I have not kept track of what is included, what the potential legislation is for it, or what the proposals are. And even here you have a dual-edged sword. If it gets the notoriety, you're going to have more people there. But hopefully there's more funding and there is more control in education. I would hate to see the area become so regulated that people could not explore on their own. But I really think in the writing that we can all do, we have to tell that rest of the story. We have to slow people down. And one of my rules of thumb was pretty much in any canyon that you're in, your speed through there should be 1 mile per one side of canyon per day.
Hmm.
And then you might get a feel for it. But it's the biology, the changes that have occurred there. When we were first there, where there was a lot of cattle still going into Grand Gulch. It was overgrazed. The water was readily available. Now the cattle are gone, and it's reclaiming itself, and the water's disappeared because it's back where it should be, underground. Hmm. So there's multiple phases of education, but it has to include the environment. It has to include the attitude of the person. And you can educate, but you also have to have an arm of enforcement.
What is your favorite experience out there? You must have spent, I can't imagine the countless hours, times that you've spent exploring Cedar Mesa, all of that area. Can you tell me one of your favorite stories or one of your favorite experiences from being out at Cedar Mesa?
Well, you get a lot of aha moments, but probably one of the most aha experiences I had was that Sally Cole, who's a very local and very very excellent rock art specialist, and I were doing a trip together in one of the canyons and came across what we called petroglyphs with shepherd staffs. They were crook-neck staffs. At that point, there was little known about it. And a few weeks later, I came back with another group, and we were looking at the rock art, discussing the shepherd staffs. It was pretty hot, and we went on down canyon a little bit and found a little tiny hole for shade, and we were discussing this, what the meaning of this thing was, and As we were leaving, I jumped off a ledge, and behind the rock was one of the staffs.
Wow.
And you got to wonder about stuff like that.
Absolutely.
And so then you're in a dilemma, and that's for a variety of reasons. That's where I started coining the outdoor museum, mm-hmm. is that if we can create a respect that leaves these things in place, with the same idea, you're not going to break a glass cabinet in a museum and take this stuff home with you. And once something's left, and it took a long time for me to learn this too, you lose 90% of the story. All you've got is the artifact. The context, where it's placed, how it's placed, all those things, no matter what it is, even shards of pottery. And if you're looking at, say, 10, 15,000 people a year going through Grand Gulch, and each one of them takes one piece of pottery, you've lost 15,000 pieces of evidence.
And it's not long before it's all gone, really, just kind of stripped away.
No, and it's, you know, in the early days, the damage was already there from the early expeditions. Mm. And so Grand Gulch never contained a lot of pristine sites or artifacts after, say, 1890. And so what we were looking at, but even on the main visited ruins at that point, there were still sandals coming out of the midden. And now you're lucky to find a piece of string or stuff like that. And Tom, for me, I really can't take it anymore because we saw it. We saw what happened. And so my time now is spent on the reservation.
Yeah.
There's nobody there, and it's heavily regulated.
Yeah.
So, and you find that. Just one quick note. I know we're running out of time.
No, go ahead.
But I think if this happens a lot with archaeologists, and there was a book that was produced in the 1970s called Camera, Spade, and Pin. I believe it was by Mark Gade. And in there, you really get insights into archaeologists that worked on pristine sites that could not go back again after they had experienced those initial things. But I'd like to repeat that for a visitor that's never been there, their first experience in walking into a site is going to be the same one I had 30 years ago. God, I can't. 30, almost 40 years ago.
Now. Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point that you bring up. And as a former archaeologist myself, I do have that sense of grief a lot of times when you're...
...wrestling on a book right now that I call the Unguide Book to Grand Gulch. Hmm. So where we just take a section and we thoroughly... explain biology, geology, archaeology, but you have to find it first, and then you can leaf through it. I don't know if that'll work, but in the sense they're going to discover it, they won't lose all that self-discovery by gaining knowledge from it.
It'll enhance it.
It'll enhance it, yeah. And I was told by one publisher, if you're going to do a guidebook, do a guidebook, and I said, well, I guess I'm not doing a guidebook. And so, anyway,
there's the Unguide book.
The Unguide book to Cedar Mesa might be the way to go. I don't know.
All right. Well, Fred, thanks so much for joining me this morning. It's very interesting to hear your perspectives on Cedar Mesa. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks. We'll be back.
Friends of Cedar Mesa will be holding their 2013 Celebrate Cedar Mesa event this Saturday, November 2nd in Bluff, Utah. The theme of this year's event is Beyond the Archaeological Story. You have been listening to the Wednesday Morning Zine on KSJD. I am Tom Yoder. Stay tuned. The Mo Show is coming up next.